At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We're going to take you back to the land of toxic assets today. They're still out there, toxic as ever. And nobody knows what to do with them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 6th of January today. Moody's, the credit rating agency, raised its earnings forecast this morning. It's going to do just fine, thank you very much. Profits are expected to be up around 9% from a year ago. Moody's is one of the three ratings agencies that, as you might remember, gave AAA grades, the highest those grades go, to billions of dollars in what turned out to be worthless mortgage-backed securities. Seems the raters are still having a hard time getting it right. A couple of weeks ago, Standard & Poor's announced it's going to lower its ratings on a whole bunch of mortgage-backed bonds. ProPublica's Jesse Eisinger had the story today in the New York Times Deal Book section. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
These rating agencies have been downgrading mortgage-backed securities for a while now. What's the big deal about this announcement by S&P?
Well, this announcement is about ratings that they put on in 2010 and 2009 after the financial crisis, after they were supposed to take into account that housing crash that you may have heard of, and they are still making mistakes.
Well, what I get from your story in the paper today is that even after 2 years or 2.5 years of financial crisis, they don't understand how to do these mortgage-backed securities. The raters just don't get it.
It's pretty astonishing, but they made some very basic methodological errors here. They didn't know how to account for the way interest was supposed to flow through these complex securities. Now, I can't figure that out, but they're the rating agencies. They're supposed to be doing that, and they didn't do it properly. And so they admitted that they'd messed up on almost 1,200 securities.
And these 1,200 securities, we ought to mention, are of a specific kind. They're called re-REMIX, and they are, in fact, bonds that had already gone bad.
Yes, they were sort of do-overs by Wall Street. They took bad bonds, and then they rebundled them and split them up again, just like the sort of magic stuff that they did during the boom. And the rating agencies obligingly rated a big portion of them AAA. And now they're reassessing those, and they've already downgraded some of these AAAs, have gone into default, which is stunningly rapid and shouldn't really happen. And many more may do so or be downgraded very soon.
You'll understand me if I say that this is deeply, deeply distressing news.
I agree. I think that the fact that the rating agencies don't really have a handle on this kind of stuff raises big questions. And now you would think, well, at least there's some reform coming. At least there's Dodd-Frank.
Right, the Financial Reform Act, yeah.
Exactly. Unfortunately, those reforms are being rolled back. They're in limbo. So we really have almost nothing substantively changing except for sort of the goodwill of the rating agencies and Wall Street to change this process.
And how much goodwill is there on the part of these rating agencies to fix what they clearly still don't understand?
Well, the problem is that they're still susceptible to the things that got them in trouble in the first place. One of the things is that the Wall Street banks pay for the ratings, and they know a lot more about the bonds that they put into these structures. And so they can be gamed, the rating agencies can be gamed by Wall Street. The other thing is that they really care about market share, these rating agencies. And so what happens is the Wall Street firms can go shopping for the most lenient ratings, and that doesn't give the rating agencies much incentive to get it right.
So here's a heretical thought. What would happen if the ratings agencies just disappeared?
In some ways, we could just use prices, bond prices, that would substitute for ratings. That would be a wonderful thing. But the problem is the infrastructure of the capital markets is so dependent on ratings. It's easy, and it's a kind of protection against our own laziness.
Jesse Eisinger, he writes for ProPublica and the New York Times Dealbook. Jesse, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
You might want to look over your next bank statement a bit more closely than usual, because as banks lose the ability to charge certain fees for you using your plastic, they're getting very serious about making money from your checking account. Bank of America is set to start testing a new fee system, a choice of four account types based on things like how much money customers keep at the bank and how much money they're not costing the bank. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
Bank of America's plan divides customers into four groups and charges them monthly fees based on how much money and how many accounts they have with the bank. Here's B of A spokeswoman Ann Pace.
We're really trying to offer customers more choices in how they can bank with us and then more ways for customers to pay for those.
Those fees range from $6 to $25 a month. Customers can avoid them if they have at least $50,000 with the bank or by doing their banking in certain ways.
They talk about being able to pay with money or being able to pay with behavior.
Bart Narder is a banking analyst with Celent. He says B of A is trying to encourage customers to do all of their banking online or at an ATM, basically paying them to stay out of the branches.
If they'll train you to make your deposit in the ATM, which costs them less money than having you walk up and deal with a person, they'll reward you for that by not charging you a monthly fee.
B of A, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and others are trying new cost-cutting and money-making tactics, says Ken Thomas, who teaches finance at Wharton. He says they're trying to make up for revenue they'll lose because of new regulations that restrict formerly lucrative fees.
Billions of dollars of fees, overdraft fees, all the credit and debit fees that they used to get, they're not going to get those anymore. And this is where they're going to start making it up.
That could be tough. Thanks to regulation, banks stand to bring in $12 billion less in fees than they did last year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The BP oil spill is back in the news today. A commission appointed by the president has released the key chapter of a report on that spill. It lays the blame squarely at the feet of BP and its contractors Halliburton and Transocean. And it goes on to point a collective finger at the oil industry and say all of you need to shape up. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe reports.
This portion of the report clearly answers the whodunit question of the BP spill, but energy analyst Kevin Book says it also addresses a broader question, one that the oil industry has been asking about regulators.
Were they going to, if you'll pardon the phrase, hate the player or the game? In this case, it looks like it's the game that's in the crosshairs.
What's game-changing about this report, he says, is that it suggests not only continuing strict regulations for offshore drilling, but slowing the permitting process further. But, Book says, the commission is not trying to stop deepwater drilling.
Their report is actually providing a stable, long-term drilling future, but the cost of doing it is probably a longer delay in the short to intermediate term.
Oil companies say those delays will cost too much and won't improve safety. Lobbyist Lou Polarisi heads the Energy Policy Research Foundation. He says fewer domestic offshore projects just means importing more oil by tanker, and tankers have spilled more historically.
This is kind of the real failure in the administration, I think, is to understand systemic risk.
But Bill Riley, who co-chaired the National Commission, says there is more risk in drilling deeper and deeper, and it only makes sense that safety measures keep pace.
Applying that technology and the same level of ingenuity and attention and resources to safety can reassure everybody.
Riley says it's not just the public or government, but the oil industry itself that should want to ensure it can drill with less risk. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
First down day for the blue chips for the year on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said today he's going to cut $78 billion from his budget over the next 5 years. Gates told the House Armed Services Committee the Pentagon's going to lower troop levels and cancel or scale back some weapon systems. That'll be good news for the national budget deficit, but perhaps it's going to hurt some local bottom lines, as Tanya Ott reports from WBHM.
It's been a busy year for business in Huntsville, Alabama. Tommy Battle is the mayor.
We were counting up the other day. We had 159 ribbon cuttings in this community this past year. I don't think any other community in the U.S. has had that.
Many of those ribbon cuttings have ties to biotechnology and engineering. Huntsville is known for NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, but it's also home to the Army's Redstone Arsenal and the nation's second largest research park.
Military spending is one of the most recession-proof sectors, not only because we're fighting a war, but because we have the constant need to improve our technology.
That's Casey Bork. He's a sociologist at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. His research shows that states with high levels of defense spending have lower unemployment and higher family incomes. But Bork says the type of military spending makes a difference. Towns that revolve around military bases don't do as well as cities like Huntsville, where defense contracting drives the economy. To get a firsthand look, I went to CFD Research Corporation, where Samir Singhal shows me a video of their latest project. What you see is a really big live beetle. Researchers hope to implant a tiny biobattery inside the beetle. The battery would turn sugars, like the beetle's own glucose, directly into electrical energy.
And you can use that energy to power cameras or sensors and essentially make unmanned aerial vehicle where it can fly into a war zone or a burning building ahead of the human. It can signal back if there's dangerous chemicals in that area.
If it works, the biobattery wouldn't just power an insect Borg. It could also help charge human pacemakers. CFD's Executive Vice President Sammy Hopshi says this mix of military contracts and technology aimed at the general public is key to his company and the city's success. It ensures a steady stream of engineers and scientists.
There is a wealth of talent here in Huntsville. It's easy to recruit talents, and the customer is just next door.
And the riches trickle down. Sociologist Casey Bork says for every one military or defense contracting job, there are 2.5 spin-off jobs.
Okay, so this is the Penchant Legacy Gallery that we have.
Jobs like Jenny Lane's. She works for the Huntsville Museum of Art, which recently opened an $8 million expansion. Lane says it was surprisingly easy to raise the money, even with the difficult economy.
You live here, and you're almost kind of cushioned from part of the horror, I guess, that everybody else was seeing. I mean, I don't think we got hit nearly as bad as the rest of the country, and for that I'm incredibly thankful.
And sociologist Casey Bork says that's why politicians lobby so hard for military spending. In Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
One of the questions on our minds this week as we greet 2011 full of enthusiasm for the news yet to come has been this. What now? What will this year bring that we'll have to come to grips with? Today, commentator David Frum's thoughts turn to foreign trade.
The financial historian Neil Ferguson calls it Chimerica, the strange hybrid relationship across the Pacific.
China exports, the United States imports. China lends, the United States borrows. China is growing fast, the United States is not growing fast. What's next in this relationship? Here's one prediction. The Chinese currency will increase in value again, as it has increased before, from over 8 to the dollar to now just over 6, soon to, who knows. By keeping the Chinese currency low, China has accelerated its exports. It has also accelerated its own inflation. The price of cooking oil jumped by over 27% in China in the past year. That's the stuff of which revolutions are made, never mind what is happening to the price of real estate. So they will up value sooner or later, as they have done before. They will have to. But what happens then? Americans might reasonably expect that a higher currency China will be less competitive. They expected the same of Japan as the yen rose in value in the 1970s and 1980s. Instead, Japan migrated up the added value ladder, industry shifting from more basic to more sophisticated goods. There's no reason that China can't follow, and it likely will. People speculate about China dumping its dollars, abruptly selling its dollar-denominated bonds, forcing an asset crash. Why would they do that? But sooner or later, they will want to use those dollars. If they don't want to buy American goods, they will buy American hard assets, again as the Japanese did. Look for Chinese investment in U.S. real estate and Chinese purchases of U.S. companies. This sounds like it could be a formula for synergy. If we were dealing with a country that was already a good friend, like Japan, so it would be. As is, expect conflict.
David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum. He's also a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Our commentary series, What Now?, wraps up tomorrow with a peek into the future of the tech geek. Your views and previews are always welcome. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says Contact. Coming up.
I'm feeling comfortable, earning enough money not to starve. I don't think I will go back to Germany.
Why the Young Turks aren't going back. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 25 points today, about 0.2%, settled at 11,697. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, also 0.2%, closed at 1,273. But the NASDAQ added 7 points, around 0.3%, finished at 2,709. Disappointing retail sales last month helped the Gap and Target each shed nearly 7% today. Macy's unraveled 4%. Investors closed the books on Amazon stock by 0.8%. The cup was half empty for Constellation Brands, maker of Mondavi wines and other adult beverages. The company reported weaker wine sales and shares withered on the vine, but dropped about 0.8% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.4%. I like to have a joke every now and then. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store. And by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for December. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for November. And it was all about music, big dreams, and leg warmers. The television show Fame premiered on January 7, 1982. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. And forget the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Denver is the place to be this week if you really want to tear it up. The American Economic Association started its annual meeting there today. And among the panel discussions on the effect of institutions on wages and breakout sessions on evaluating empirical tools for horizontal merger analysis, which, by the way, I am not making up, there is also going to be talk of ethics and whether or not economists should have to abide by a code thereof. A documentary last year called Inside Job raised some pointed questions about conflicts of interest and professional economists. Annie Lowrey covers business and the economy for Slate magazine. Annie, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
There are some amazing examples in that film, Inside Job, of really high-profile economists getting some really big consulting contracts.
So one example is that a Columbia Business School professor and a very prominent economist took some money from the Icelandic Chamber of Commerce, essentially to write a paper about the Icelandic banking system, and he praised it. And shortly thereafter, the Icelandic banking system collapsed, and then Iceland collapsed. And so that's a particularly egregious case where, you know, perhaps he should have known a bit better, and perhaps he should have looked a little bit closer at taking money to write a paper like that.
What does economic research say about the ethics of economists? You've been looking into this.
There's a number of studies that economists themselves have done that show that they are perhaps a little bit less ethical than the general population. For instance, in zero-sum games, they'll tend to keep more money for themselves than average people.
Explain that a little bit, zero-sum games.
Essentially, if you have a pot of money, say like 10 bucks, and the game is that you and I are playing, and I get to divvy it up into two portions, and then you know, you can either keep or reject your portion. So if you accept my offer, both of us win. Mm-hmm. And if you reject my offer, you know, neither of us do. Your average person on the street, on average, will end up keeping about $5.44, something like that. And economists will keep about $6.15.
So more than their fair share, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's just one instance. And there's been dozens of studies like this that show that economists are maybe unsurprisingly penurious and also maybe a little bit less ethical.
What about the disclosure of these relationships of the consulting firms and the contracts and the dollar amounts?
There have been two good studies. And the first and the more comprehensive one shows that a number of prominent economists only would give the full extent of their affiliations about 2% of the time. So they might be accepting money from a big bank or, you know, a mortgage company, and they wouldn't be revealing that even if they were writing about something that's pertinent to the issue. The even more damning one in my mind was a study that looked at economists testifying to Congress, either to Senate Banking Committee or House Financial Services Committee, and about a third of the time when they were talking about issues relevant to the companies that they were taking money from, they still didn't disclose that fully.
Here's the thing, though, Annie. I mean, everybody has conflicts of interest, right? Journalists have conflict of interest. Politicians have conflicts of interest. What's the practical effect when you have these economists giving this advice and not disclosing relationships or even having the relationships in the first place? What do we know about that?
Well, the issue is the lack of transparency first and foremost. To be surprised on the back end that an economist has, for instance, taken money from a mortgage company, but then also talked about economic policies that would regulate the mortgage business, you know, that is relevant. And what's kind of ironic about it is that, of course, economists know that conflicts of interest create inefficiencies and information asymmetries always work out to the benefit of one side. So we might not be able to say, well, this person, you know, for instance, influenced this piece of legislation to his direct economic benefit. It might not be that. But as a broader sort of series of questions, I think that it would be a good idea for economists to at least come out and do this because the downside for them, to me, seems very small.
Annie Lowrey, she's the business and economics correspondent at Slate. Annie, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
We had the director of Inside Job on the program a couple of months ago, the documentary that arguably got the American Economic Association thinking about ethics guidelines in the first place. You can hear my interview with Charles Ferguson on our website. It's marketplace.org. There was a report out today from the European Commission talking about consumer sentiment over there. It's pretty high, back to where it was before the recession started. That's thanks in part to how well Europe's biggest economy, Germany, is doing. It's doing so well, as we told you yesterday, that Germany is having trouble filling all the jobs it has. That labor shortage is being made worse by a specific pattern of reverse migration. For the first time since Germany started importing workers from Turkey 50 years ago, more Turks are moving out of Germany than are moving in. From Istanbul, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Ahmet Bahadurlar is driving around the pleasant suburb of Bahçeşehir on the outskirts of Istanbul. Ahmet settled here when he arrived in Turkey more than a year ago because it reminded him of Germany, the country where he was born.
I was looking for the Germany in Istanbul, or the Germany in Turkey. Bahçeşehir is a planned suburb. I'm living in a gated community.
He likes his gated apartment complex, not because he's worried about crime. It's because in unruly Istanbul, he craves German-style order, prompting the question, why did he leave Germany?
I never felt really comfortable in Germany. Maybe I behave like a German, I think like a German, but I never feel like a German. I always feel myself as a foreigner.
Even his German friends, he says, were too ready to dismiss all Turks there as muggers or Muslim fanatics. But here in Istanbul, he feels at home. And since he makes a living as a day trader and all he needs is a laptop and an internet connection, he says the move has been fairly seamless. He thinks he'll stay.
I'm feeling comfortable, earning enough money not to starve. I don't think so that I will go back to Germany. I don't think so.
A ferry ride away across the Bosphorus Strait on the other side of Istanbul, another young German Turk has a rather different story to tell. Architect Emine Şahin says she never suffered discrimination growing up in Germany. She came back to Turkey 4 years ago for economic reasons, because the construction industry was booming here. She donned a hard hat and worked as a site manager, and here she encountered discrimination.
I mean, as a woman in a construction sector, it's difficult because it's a sector male-dominated, and it's difficult.
Difficult to get male workers to carry out her instructions. Now she works in real estate development and has other frustrations, like, she claims, Turkish timekeeping.
The German people are punctual. If you have your appointment, if you have your meeting at 10 o'clock, you will be there 2 minutes to 10. But in Turkey, they are sometimes 2 hours late, and they say, okay, I'm sorry because it was traffic. But if you know there is traffic, go 2 hours earlier.
The German Turks, it must be said, are not entirely popular with the locals. This song reflects the hostility. It tries to defend the returnees against the charge that they're inconsiderate. Others claim the incomers speak poor Turkish. There's always going to be a cultural clash, says business manager Yildiz Taylan. She left Turkey at the age of 9 and now is back from Germany at the age of 40 to find her roots.
I am very, very German. I have to admit it. The first step that finding myself and finding the culture is to admit, okay, I'm too German to be Turkish anymore. I'm sorry, it's gone.
Nevertheless, thanks to Turkey's buoyant economy, many thousands more seem likely to follow her path. A recent survey suggests that one-third of all German-Turkish college students plan to pursue a career in Turkey. In Istanbul, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, by way of setting up some news from tomorrow, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is going to be making his first appearance before the 112th Congress. It's going to be his first session since the Fed started buying Treasury bills. Quantitative easing is the catchphrase you've heard. Meanwhile, Paul Ryan, the new head of the House Budget Committee, has some changes in mind for the Fed. Ryan said today he's going to introduce a bill to get rid of what is known as the Fed's dual mandate, the current requirement the central bank has, that it control inflation and maintain full employment. Just inflation fighting from now on. is what Mr. Ryan wants. So that's Bernanke tomorrow morning. Also, the December jobs report as well. And until then, that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 25 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ added 7 points, about 0.3%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, also 0.2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up, back here next time.
You can walk into a Caterpillar dealer with no questions asked and buy a Kia for $995, and it would start any Caterpillar machine.
Stealing bulldozers, it's just that easy. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.